Looking to build a web developer portfolio but not sure where to start? Go to techrally.co and click courses to sign up for the Practical Portfolio course. You will use HTML, CSS, JavaScript, and GitHub to not only build your application, but also deploy to Netlify. Start your software developer journey with a strong portfolio at techrally.co. Welcome to Outside the Code, a show about the stories behind the professionals in the tech industry. Hi, I'm Alex from Tech Rally, and on the show today we have Annie Bombani, a software engineer lead at Pastel. It's very easy to assume you know someone's life based on a snapshot in time. That is far from the case with Annie, who traveled all over the world from Australia, Japan, and now Canada. We talk about how each of these moments shaped her into who she is now, and how she got into tech because of it. There's a lot to unpack, and I'm super excited to share her story. Hello, Annie. How are you?
Hi, Alex or Tech Rally. I never know which one to refer to you as.
I don't even know either. I think a lot of my friends call me Alex, and then, or I guess
am I your friend? I met with,
that's questionable. Yeah, no, I'm kidding. Yeah, you can call me Alex. I mean, obviously you already do, so that must mean we're friends, right?
Yeah, okay. I'll take it.
Yes. So, hello, Annie.
Hello, Alex.
Yeah, there we go. So, if our listeners didn't notice, you kind of have an accent. Where is that accent from?
My accent is from Australia.
Ooh.
And is it that pronounced?
It's very different from mine, at least.
Oh, okay. I feel like we sound the same, but I don't know. I guess not.
Well, I was going to ask you, since moving to the States, and I guess States includes Canada, do you feel that the way you speak is different, or is it pretty much everyone kind of has that same accent, or do you notice the accents?
I feel like Canadians have a very neutral accent, so mm-hmm. I don't hear my accent when I speak so much, but other people tend to hear it. And I feel like because I've been here for a while, if I keep thinking that my accent has, you know, decreased or like gotten a lot softer. But I know if I speak to another Aussie, it gets like really strong.
Yeah, I've heard a lot about those situations where if you're around people that you're familiar with, whether it's community mm-hmm. or whether it's race or anything, you're kind of... I guess in Korean, I forgot what they call it, but just your tone changes completely. So you just match with the vibes. Yeah.
Yeah. It's probably a social thing, right? Like you want to kind of like match,
fit into
with the community and everything. So if there was like an Aussie, I'll be like, hey, how's it going? Do you want to like, you know, have a barbie and tomorrow Avo or something?
What is that? I'm sure that makes way more sense to another Aussie than just someone that was born in California.
Yeah. Avo is a good word. I love the word Avo. It's so easy to say, by the way.
What does it mean?
Afternoon. So tomorrow, Avo. It's tomorrow afternoon.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. One thing I picked up in Texas, I mean, obviously still the United States, is that is y'all. And it just makes so much more sense now. Back mm-hmm. in the day, I would just go, you guys, or whatever along those lines. But I mean, even now just saying guys versus guys and gals, or trying to include y'all, just does both. So now I go, yeah, hey, what are y'all up to? And then now it just applies to everybody. And it's like, yes.
I feel like it's a bit of a tech thing as well, because, you know, in tech, there's like a movement to move away from you guys and stuff. So I'm also trying to say like your, but it sounds a bit strange to me still, but I feel like I'm more comfortable writing it than I am saying it.
What do people in Australia say if you don't say y'all?
You guys.
Use. I see.
Yeah, use.
What do use up to?
Yep. That's it.
Interesting. So yeah. If our listeners didn't know, I mean, you moved from Australia to the States. Do you ever feel like you're becoming less
Canada.
And less Canada? That is right. You're totally right. I was going to say, what do they call Canada? I guess they call it States because United States, right? And then I guess Canada is just Canada. Do they go Edda? No, they probably don't. That just sounds weird. I'm just talking to myself at this point. But you interrupted my question, so I couldn't think.
Sorry.
But I was going to say, now that you're in Canada, do you ever feel that you're becoming less and less Australian each day?
A little bit, because everyone around me, you know, especially in Toronto, has like, see, like when I first came to Toronto, I said Toronto, but people here say Toronto. So like over time, I can feel like certain things like that change. And also with language and like linguistics and stuff, I've kind of forgotten like what I used to say versus what I say now, like sidewalk versus pavement or lift versus elevator. There's a few small things like that. It's like really subtle differences, but I don't feel like I'm becoming more Canadian, but I definitely like observe some of my speech patterns changing and stuff like that. I still hate the cold though.
Yeah, we could talk about the weather later, but I'd be curious, do you feel that your vernacular changing, or just the way you word things changing, changes your identity at times?
Yeah, I think it's a bit of both as well, because there's this idea, I don't know if you heard of it before, but it's like what you think shapes what you speak, and what you speak shapes like your actions, and your actions shape who you are, something like that. I'm probably like completely butchering that. But I definitely think, I feel like it's less just being in Canada, but in the last 2 years with the pandemic and just like being in tech specifically has had a big impact on like identity and who I am and how I fit in with, in I guess like the world or the wider scheme of things, especially with like tech Twitter as well, because that's such like a bubble. So you're reading like certain things and then the algorithm feeds you the very similar things and stuff like that. So you kind of feel like, oh, this is my world now. But then when you get out of it, there's like a lot more stuff, you know, that kind of like explains who you are and the things you're interested in. I don't know, I have those kind of experiences where like sometimes I'm like really into tech, but then I take a break and like I go snowboarding, and then it's like a return to who I was before, if that makes sense. So yeah,
and we're definitely going to hit on that as well. But I really do feel that, especially with your journey, not just tech journey, but just journey in general, you probably have experienced a lot of different things in your life, and I want to hit on all of those things. But before I do, what do you miss about Australia?
I miss the sunshine and the sense of space. I know that sounds really weird, but I live in the city, and there's always one thing I think I just like remember being back in Australia and just like looking up in the sky, and it's so vast and endless, and it's just that feeling of spaciousness and openness. I really miss that, and I just miss hearing Aussie accents around me and feeling like, hey, I belong here, I don't sound different, and it just makes sense, and it's not right. cold.
And it's usually. Not cold.
Yeah.
That makes sense. And as much as you do miss Australia and all those things that you're familiar with, there must have, at least in my eyes looking from outside in, was there a sense of isolation? Because weirdly enough, you know, Australia is pretty far away from a lot of different things. And to even get there from Toronto, New York, yeah, it's going to take 24 hours or something like that. So did you ever just feel isolated or just curious about the world?
Yeah, definitely growing up. And I grew up in Australia, but it's a little bit more than that. I like to be specific. I grew up on a tiny island called Christmas Island. And so that's like super tiny. So coming from just like a really small island where I think there was probably about 1,500 people when I was growing up, and that was like my entire life. And then the world that I knew was just the island and the books that I read. So it was kind of like, and I was like a vicarious reader, so I would just like read all the time. I had a special, like my library card at school, I was able to borrow more books than anybody else, because I would just like borrow books and then I'd read all night and then return all the books tomorrow, like the next day and stuff. Like, I think I was just always had that curiosity about what the world beyond Christmas Island was like. So yeah, I read a lot, and like when you're immersed in those kind of, you know, fictionist worlds that created by the books and the authors, it's kind of like, I remember the sense of like, I have to go and see these places. Like the world is so much bigger than you know, just like me being on this island. And I always felt like I wanted to leave and escape and, yeah, like see the world.
Yeah. And was it a norm to just stay on the island, even within the context of Australia, to stay on that specific island? Or do a majority of your friends kind of venture off to more of the major cities in Australia? Was that their limits? Or like, what was the kind of general sentiment of people within your community?
Mm-hmm. So on Christmas Island, there was the school was up to year 10. So we had like pre-primary to year 10. And then for year 11 and 12 in uni, people would then go to the mainland. The closest main city is Perth in Western Australia. And Christmas Island comes like under the Western Australian like jurisdiction or government as well, like the local government there. So majority, I would say about 99% of people then went to Perth to finish like year 11 and 12 and university. So that's pretty normal. Like not a lot of people actually stay to continue their education. It's pretty normal for people to then, yeah, like go to Perth.
Is that what you did?
Yeah. Yeah. I went to Perth by myself when I was like in year 11. I don't know how old I was like at that age. Do you know? I'm really bad with like numbers and dates and stuff.
16, 17,
it's
I assume.
Great. Yeah. I feel like it's a little bit younger than that, but maybe you're right. Yeah, 15-ish.
Wait, so you had to go by yourself without your parents? Were you just living in some kind of dormitory or something in high school? Or
so I had cousins. Yeah. I had cousins in Australia, so I stayed with them for a little while. And then places that I just found, not homestay, but yeah, people with like rentals and stuff. In Australia, it's like something that I've seen over here, like in North America, is that when kids, like students, go to university, it's like really, really common to move out, right? I think it is, yeah. But in Australia, it's common to actually stay with your parents. So it's a really different kind of lifestyle. And until year 12, like I always wore like a school uniform and stuff. So it's quite different. Like to me, when I think of American schools, I think of the kind of shows I see on TV with like Lindsay Lohan and that kind of stuff. I don't know if it's actually like that, but like that's kind of the impression that I get.
And I assume that once you finished school and then you went to uni, you did take a design major, I believe. Is that is that right?
Yeah, multimedia design.
No, got it. And knowing what you knew then, where you were reading a bunch of books, trying to explore the world possibly, why did you choose multimedia design?
So I always, like when I was growing up, I drew a lot. We didn't have a art curriculum on Christmas Island, but I was friends with the, what's the boss of the school called? The principal. I was friends with the principal. And she was actually like a really creative person. So she actually created like a curriculum for me, like an art curriculum. So she was like kind of tutoring me in a sense. So after I did that, like on Christmas Island, when I went to Perth, I studied at a school called Applecross, and that was a special arts school. Now I didn't get into the arts program there, but everyone like for year 11 and 12 thought I was in the special arts program. Like all my teachers thought I was in special arts. I won like a bunch of the awards for like the standard arts and stuff. I had a painting that was exhibited at the Art Gallery of Western Australia, and it was one of the ones chosen to travel to Japan on one of those like student exchange things. So I did a lot of art at school, but I also felt that I couldn't make a career out of art because, you know, like the money is really hard. Like, how do you sell your paintings and that kind of stuff?
So how do you make a living?
Exactly. Yeah. So I went to the next best thing, which was design. Basically, that was my whole thought process around that. I was like, probably can't survive being, you know, a broke homeless artist. So I'll go into design. It has computers. And I remember when my aunt and uncle were like, oh, what do you do? Like, I would just be like, oh, yeah, I work with computers. I think I said design, but, like, when they asked more, I'd just be like, oh, yeah, yeah, it's, like, with computers because it sounds like it's, like, a legitimate career choice.
Isn't it so funny how even at that age, we're so practical about the decisions that we make. Because I actually really liked physics back in the day in high school, but I don't think physicians or whatever you call them, the physicists, whatever. I don't even know what they're called, so they probably don't get paid that well. But in my head, I was thinking I got to go into engineering because engineering is practical, and that's something that could, you know, it's not going to make me rich, but it'll get me a job. So that's kind of, I went towards that direction, even though I may not have a huge passion for it, but it was the most practical. And, you know, college, at least in the States, are pretty expensive. And I didn't want to, just not take advantage of the situation that I was in. So, that's kind of why I made the decision. But obviously now I'm a software engineer and things change. But yeah, even at an early age, sometimes you do make a lot of decisions for practical reasons.
I have to say, though, with design, like, I definitely like design. Like, my first year was, like, typography, freelance drawing, photography, 3D animation. Like, it was so much fun. It was, like, all those, like, fun things. It was a very general first year of design before people started to specialize after that. Like, some people went into advertising, other people went into marketing, or I went into, like, multimedia, like, specifically, which was a bit more digital as opposed to graphic, and there was that stream as well. So yeah, like I felt like it was definitely the right decision for me. Like I did when I was interviewing at the university, I definitely got into the art school with like my portfolio and stuff. But I definitely was curious about what the design industry looked like and like being able to do all those like fun, cool things. Like it was all new to me, right? Like going and doing Adobe and like Final Cut Pro editing, video editing, sound editing, like all of that was so new and it was really exciting. It was fun. And yeah, part of the experience.
Yeah, of course, learning is always fun. But once you graduated and started your first job, what was that experience like? What were some positives? What were some negatives? I kind of already know the story of what you did afterwards, but maybe at the time, what were you feeling? Once you started your job, I'm sure there was a little bit of excitement, but it, you know, like all things, excitement does wear down.
Yeah, it does. Okay, so I graduated and then I was out of Perth, man. Like I was out of there. I interviewed.
What's wrong with Perth?
Well, like I wanted to see the world.
True.
So I actually I had like my graduation exhibition and everything. So I interviewed for a few positions. And if I was to have gotten the position at the Perth Mint, which would be like designing like coins and stuff, like special edition coins, I would have stayed, but I didn't get it. I think like one person who did like a graphic design specific course got it. So I was like, oh, well, I guess I'm going backpacking then. So I literally just like took off and left, went around the world. Like I was overseas for a year and a half. So I had my degree. I was, to be honest, like it was a 3-year degree. And by the end of it, I was just like done. I don't know, like maybe like a lot of people just feel that way, but I was just like ready to leave. So I went away. I left Australia for a year and a half, went backpacking, like did all that stuff, like, you know, grew, learned, expanded my mind, blah, blah, blah. And then I came back to Perth. I was really lucky because I was really good friends with my university professor. So I managed to stay with him when I got back to Perth. And he knew a couple of guys running a design studio at the time. So I actually brought my like really big portfolio. It was like, you know, a actual thing back then. And I went and had like a talk to them, like just a chat and be like, hey, like how's the industry going? Like what's going on in Perth? This is my portfolio. Do you have any tips for me? And that kind of stuff, just like a really casual chat. And they actually emailed me a few days later and was like, do you want a job? And that's literally how I got my first design job.
Wow.
Yeah.
Were you doing any doodling or some design while you're traveling? Or was it just pure, this is any time. I don't really want to do anything else. This is just me getting to know what the world is.
I did a lot of random things. I probably drew a little bit, but the main thing that I did was probably write. So I had like a journal and stuff, and I would constantly like send a few travel updates back to people. And I had, yeah, like I had my journal and I would, I wrote a lot back then.
What did you write about?
Just like people I met, my impressions of places, what I felt, what I was doing, my hopes, dreams and desires, you know, all that stuff.
when you're traveling, you do meet a lot of people. Do you feel that you stay in touch with some of them still, or majority of them? It's one of those things where it was good when we met at that time, but sometimes, you know, you just got to move forward and, you know, you meet more and more different people, and that's just kind of like the group that you're at. But is it just more of like a, do you think about it from a perspective of, oh, I wish we were still friends, or do you think about it more from a, like, oh, this was a good memory that I'll like cherish, and then it's just like, if we do see each other, then oh, obviously we'll just pick up where we left off kind of thing.
Have you seen the movie Fight Club?
I have, yeah.
Okay, so in the movie, there's a term that I thought about it a lot when I was traveling, and that is single-use friends. Maybe it was something different, but when you're traveling, a lot of times, like, you, as a solo traveler, you meet a lot of other solo travelers, or and you don't know people, right? So you naturally form a connection, and you like do things together. Like, you have those experiences of the places, and you, like, I don't know, eat like gelato if you're in Italy and stuff, and you go to those places and you have those experiences together. There are friends that I still keep in touch with, like, to this day, and they're, you know, all around the world and stuff, but a lot of people probably not. And I did stuff like couch surfing and stuff as well, where, because, you know, I didn't have any money, man, like, so I would like crash it on like strangers' couches and stuff. Like, looking back now at some of the things that I did, I'm like, how did I do that? Like, that's probably pretty dangerous for just like a single, you know, girl, like, just traveling backpacking by herself, like, in all over Europe and whatever. But I just did it. So
ignorance is bliss sometimes. Now you're too smart for your own good, you know.
I probably still would do it. I think I'm just trusting. Yeah.
Ooh. But I mean, in some ways, you got to see those experiences because of your personality to just always be curious, always try something different. And I don't think a lot of people can say they've kind of lived your life or some similar to your life. And I always think it's so fun to, when you share your stories and what you do and the travels that you share with me, I'm like, dang, I need to be like that more. So if anyone could get anything out of listening to this conversation, you know, be comfortable with being uncomfortable, right? And I think that's super important. When you got your design job, how long did you work at that company for?
I was there just over a year.
Okay.
Yeah.
And we don't really need to talk about the design job too much, but I know that you went from being a designer to being an English teacher in Japan, right?
Yep. Yeah, so I went from like a design job to like a 3D animator, like in betweener type job, where I was doing some stuff with analog 3D. I was like, do you know what in betweening is?
No.
In terms of animation? So in animation, you have like keyframes where like one action happens to the next, like to the next action. If the action or like the movement happens slowly, then the keyframes are further apart. But if they're like fast, then it's like shorter apart. And the in-betweener is like the person who basically draws all the in-between states. So if you think of a film, right, like the film is like 24 frames per second. And to do like 1 second, you need like 24 different pitches, like to have like smooth movement of that kind of thing. So at the time, like there was this job I was doing, and it was like basically taking a movie and make it into analog 3D, which is like the red and blue glasses. So I was painting like depth mapping, which is just with black and white. And if something is white, then it's like further in front of the frame towards the camera. And then if it's black, it like pushes it back. So I was doing like all that kind of stuff. It's just like really random, interesting. But yeah, anyway, all that to say, then I went to Japan and decided I wanted to go to Japan and teaching. I didn't want to go teach English, but I needed a way to survive when I went to Japan. So that was like through teaching English. No, sorry. Then I went to England. Yes.
What?
Then yes. Sorry. In Australia. Okay, I did my thing. I did like the death mapping, like animation thing. Then I moved to England for a couple of years. I worked as a contract designer for a few like big companies like Reuters and Tesco.com, doing that for a few years. Then I went to Japan after that. Yeah.
Quite a journey. Not many people could say again. They did some 3D motion design type of work. But I was going to say, why did you want to go to Japan? Because it sounds like it was less about being an English teacher and more about exploring Japan. And I also want to add this. It's what I thought was so interesting was in my head, I feel like maybe the practical side wasn't thinking of, and the more just, hey, I just want to try this. Maybe I'm young. I just want to see what Japan's like. Because there are a lot of programs where, you know, people after they graduate college, they go become English teachers in like Korea, Japan, and do those things. And then they try to figure out their life. But you went from having an actual career to just being like, nope, I'm going to go back, like not backwards, but go reverse order a little bit and say, hey, I'm going to be an English teacher while living in Japan. So like, what was your thinking behind that? Did you struggle with it? Like, what was that? What was that like?
I can tell you one thing. I definitely wasn't thinking about my career.
That's, I mean, that's a fair answer, honestly.
Like, I just wanted to, okay. So I had friends back in Australia who have been to Japan and they love Japan. And until that point, I hadn't really like lived in an Asian country. It was like, you know, Australia, Canada, traveled around Europe, and then lived in England for a while as well. So I'd never experienced like living in an Asian country. And Japan seems so fascinating to me because it has like the mix of, you know, like really traditional old culture, but then it's like super modern as well. And it's just like a bunch of like juxtapositions, and it's just like so interesting. Like, I don't think there is any other culture like Japan. And I think my friends kind of sold me on that. So I wanted to go just for a couple of years. It's just like a break from design, but it just ended up like being a much longer span of time than that. It's comfortable living in Japan. As much as people say it's expensive and stuff, Japan is actually really well set up for like single people to live. As in like some of their like living environments, like living like apartments and stuff are really well set up for just like one person. They have a lot of convenience stores that you can just like buy your meals and everything. And I think that does foster a sense of isolation because it's almost like people are, it's so well catered for like one person as opposed to like a community of people. So yeah, I don't know, but at the same time, they're also like super like community minded and they think about, you know, like the greater good of the society and everything, right? So it's just like all just really interesting ideas that almost clash with each other. And I don't know, I just kind of wanted to like live there for a while and see what it was like.
What you're explaining is the juxtaposition in some ways where the lifestyle can be so super beneficial for a single person to live in their home, but at the same time, it's somehow you're able to create that community. How did you find your community? Was it through other English teachers? Was there some type of quote-unquote equivalent of a techmeetup.com kind of thing where some people may have similar hobbies? Like, how did you meet people? And was it easy to do with considering, I assume you didn't know the language fully, but like, yeah, at a basic level, I assume.
Yeah, I have survival Japanese. Most of my friends are definitely English teachers, and then you kind of meet people through that. I was also doing some like live modeling, like drawing and stuff. So once in a while, I would like go to those and events and I met a few people there, but by large it was mostly the expat community. I live in Osaka, so the expat community there isn't that big anyway, so you just end up meeting people pretty easily, I'd say.
When you were traveling around, what parts of Japan did you really, really cherish and appreciate?
Japan has so many beautiful places. I lived in Osaka because it was in the middle and because we didn't really want to live in Tokyo just in case it would be harder to learn Japanese there because we figured like most people would, you know, speak English there. But some places, like I've literally traveled from like top to bottom of Japan. Like I've traveled Japan so much and there's just like so many cool things. Like if you go to the Okinawa area, it's really tropical. It's, you know, there's like seahorses and like all the kind of fauna and flora that you get in a tropical island. But then you go all the way to Hokkaido and it's like huge mountains and snow and just the landscape, like the variety of landscape is so interesting. The onsens, hot springs are also really nice. So yeah, there's just a lot of beautiful places there.
Yeah, actually, my friend and I, we took a trip to Japan, landed in Tokyo, hung out there for about 2.5 days. And then we took a train all the way to Kyoto, stayed there for a day or two. And then we just took a train from Kyoto all the way down to like Fukuoka, I think. And while we were riding that train, it was just so beautiful to see and just have these little pit stops. And then once we got to Fukuoka, we took a boat to Busan, Korea. So I just thought that was such an interesting experience. And yeah, I don't know. I don't think a lot of people can say they've done that. And I really appreciated that being able to go from like one country to the other like that. Nothing to rave about, honestly, about the boat. It was just a really standard boat. I thought you could be able to just stand on top of the boat or something and just see the sights and stuff. But it truly felt like I was just in a typical Asian bus with that kind of setting. But no, I love Japan. The learning the language or not knowing the language while trying to navigate was a little bit tough, but everyone's just super nice there. So yeah, I love Japan.
Yeah, they
I'll go again. Yeah,
your story reminded me that when I was in, there was like one thing I wanted to do that I haven't actually done leaving Japan, was to get a boat from like from Japan to Russia and then take the train through Russia. Haven't actually done that, but it was on my bucket list for a while.
Where would you leave from?
I think north, somewhere north. If memory serves me right. I can't remember exactly, but there is a boat that you can catch to Russia. And then
would it be like the east side of Russia?
Railway. What's that?
Would it be on like basically the east side of the Russia? That makes sense. East side of Russia somewhere, I assume. Yeah. Interesting. That would be kind of cool.
Yeah.
One day. Who knows? Did you ever go to Sapporo or no?
Yes.
How's that?
It's cool. They have the Sapporo factory there with that you can go, and they have this beer. Okay, I don't really drink beer, but you know, while you're there, right? They have this beer that's kept at like a specific temperature, and it's cold, and it's really quite refreshing. It's nice. I wouldn't say it's like my favorite place because it's like a city, but I enjoyed it.
Oh yeah, I have no context of what Sapporo would be. I just have I've only tried the beer, so it's just kind of you don't really know unless you've actually been there. But I do have one question for you, and I know I sent you some questions ahead of time, but this is actually a little curveball that I like to add in. But can you explain to me what Circus Tricks Osaka is?
Yeah. You like did your research, hey? So
maybe, eh?
So I was kind of part of a group called Circus Tricks Osaka. And do you know what acro yoga is? Okay, so they were basically an acro yoga group. So I used to do acro yoga with them. It was really fun.
Did you build a pretty solid core?
I was way more fit back then than I have been the last couple of years due to COVID. I missed those times.
Did you continue the acro yoga like afterwards, or was it just more I see?
So when I moved to Toronto, I did find a few people doing it, but I think I actually went into just more like normal yoga after that. So there's a hot yoga studio not too far from me, and I was mostly doing hot yoga since I came to Toronto, except for the last 2 years, basically.
Got it. And what is this move? Is it literally called the cartwheel mix or a cartwheel?
It depends, like, on what people... there's, like, one called a washing machine. I'm not sure if that's what you're looking at.
So, basically, you have someone laying on the floor with their legs up, and then another person's grabbing their hands and kind of and moving from left
it. Might be the washing machine.
I see. Or car, that's all they're doing.
Or something. Yeah.
So, that's did so you fun. Meet those people... through your English, like the English speaking community kind of thing? Or
okay. So the way I met them was I'm into snowboarding, right? And there was a group of people going snowboarding. And so I just like said, okay, hey, I'm going to go snowboarding. So we were on like this little, like, what do you call it when it's like one person driving and everyone just like chips in money and stuff like that?
What are you talking about? pitching
organized,
into what?
It was like a like
or, an it was an organized trip.
Yeah, right. It was an organized trip basically. Uh-huh. So with like a bunch of people I did know and a couple of people I did know, and then mm-hmm. one of the people in there on the trip that I didn't know became like a good friend, and he was the person who was really into acro yoga. So mm-hmm. yeah, that's kind of how that started.
Do you feel like you could do the spin now or no?
I'll probably have to practice, but I could probably still kind of do it.
Yeah,
I can't do it. You're like on the other side of the line in Canada and America. I feel like you're looking around, be like, hey, let's do it. Like,
no, there's no way. There's no way. I'm literally just an investigator, and I just like to ask these kind of questions. So if anyone's interested in watching it, I'll put that link in my description.
Wait, how did you find it? That's so random.
You'll be surprised what when a user, you know, has a specific username and uses it across all platforms, how you can find them. But yeah, I didn't want to share that one with you because I feel like you would have been like, oh no, like what are we doing here?
It's all good. I have nothing to hide. No skeletons in my closet.
if this is a fun one, and if anything, it really just kind of emphasizes my perspective of you, or like just having these conversations with you. It's like you're always curious and you're always willing to try something new. And that's what I think I've always appreciated about the way you approach anything, work, conversations, people, like just random tasks here and there. And I just thought like, oh, like, of course Annie would do something like this because she's just like, why not, right?
So. Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. So how long were you in Japan for?
6 years.
6 years?
Yeah, it was quite a while. Yeah.
And you said you did. Yeah, I was going to say you didn't expect it to be 6 years, huh?
Yeah.
What made you finally decide, hey, this chapter is done, let's go somewhere else?
Yeah, it was pretty much, I just felt like I couldn't be an English teacher forever. I felt like I really wanted to get back into design. I'd been out of it for so long. When I was teaching though, because the lessons were one-on-one, I was drawing a lot to explain, you know, like concepts and stuff. Like for example, if I was explaining biodegradable, like I'll draw a banana and then I'll draw another one, it's just like dots. So it's like very easy to use drawing to explain concepts, like that is a lot harder to explain in words. So I was actually in some ways like drawing more during that job, just like very simple drawings. But I knew it wasn't sustainable. Like I was making like not much at all, like probably less than 30,000 a year, like all those times. So yeah, like I said, I wasn't planning my career at all. It's just kind of, I wanted to go to Japan. So I made it happen. And teaching English was the way to fund that part of my life.
Right. Sometimes there is a balance struggle or power dynamic between doing what you enjoy in terms of this exploration and figuring out life, and then at the same time, maybe as you're getting older,
yes,
you're
Dad.
Like, I have to make money. Maybe it's that internal question. And you know, at this, I struggle with this too, especially growing up in like this Asian culture where my parents, they struggle really hard to get me to where I am, and then I don't want to necessarily just take advantage of that and just, you know, not do the right thing, quote unquote, and make money and all of those. But at the same time, you personally, for me, I look at my career and I go, man, is this it? Is this where I just sit down in this desk, work this job? And I wish I got to explore those things. But at the same time, it's, you know, I've also saved a lot more money because I did those things. So what is the cost, right? And what is the cost of being able to get more of this? I don't know. You can't really put like a financial value on it, but just this experience, right? And I think that's super important. And I think one thing I'm happy about is at least I moved to New York City where, you know, the city never sleeps, and I pay a lot of money to be here. But at the same time, there's really no place like it, maybe outside of, I don't know, like Taiwan or Shanghai or something like that. But I'm so happy that I was able to at least experience this. But and likewise, I'm sure for you, like, there's no regrets, because not many people would say they lived in Japan and just got to do what you do.
I guess there are, like, it's a hard, like, way to think about it. Like, I feel like there's a lot of things that I don't regret, but there are things that I do regret as well. When you're moving around so much, it's really hard to put roots down somewhere. You're making friends, then you're leaving them. You're starting something and then you're leaving it. So in that sense, I didn't think about those things, right? You know, when I was, like, doing my period of, like, traveling and stuff, it probably wasn't, like, the most sustainable way. I grew a lot, for sure, during those times. Like, you know, I struggled, I did this, I did that. There was a lot of things that I, you know, built resilience and a lot of independence, and I was able to rely on myself a lot during those times. But definitely the thing about building, settling down and building roots and stuff, that was something that I thought about later on. Like, moving to Toronto after all of that, it was really, really, really hard. Like, really hard. Trying to get back into design after a 6-year hiatus was, like, impossible. I didn't really know anybody in the city, and it was just like, so in many ways you're just starting from scratch again and again and again, and that is the cost of like the lifestyle that I led up to that point.
That's true. I didn't think about it that way, but I've definitely thought about that specific situation that you described, where there is a lot of value of time yes. with people and quality of friends and all of those things. And especially when you're in Japan, in teaching English with other English teachers, that is not necessarily a forever job, like you just said. And mm-hmm. I'm sure a lot of your friends came in, got close to them, and they said, hey, I'm going to leave Japan now. It's been about a year or two. It's really good to know you, but I'm going back to wherever I came from. And then I'm sure those moments were very sad, and I've definitely felt that a little bit too when I lived in Texas and Austin, maybe not to the same scale, but when I moved there post college, I was still like 21, 22, and getting to know a lot of friends that were a little bit younger than me, but after mm-hmm. they graduated, they would leave Austin and they would go to Dallas or California. It just felt like these what if relationships could have been a little bit more. But it just never happens that way. And it's you do kind of have to make those sacrifices. But mm-hmm. hopefully it's taught you, now living in Toronto, there is a bit of more quality of friends that you can have because you've stayed there longer. You kind of build those relationships. Like, it's built on consistency. And now you're, like, be able to, like, I know you get dinner with your friends and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So hopefully that's been good for you. Yeah.
The thing about consistency as well, and I've thought about that, or, like, you know, like what you say, the value of time. I've thought about that in regards to, like, working and, like, being at a company, right? In tech, it's so easy to jump from one company to another. But I thought about this because, like, not too long ago, I did actually turn down a pretty, like, really good offer, I should say, especially, like, just with the name of the company that I got the offer from. But I just felt like, okay, after so many years of just, like, jumping from one thing to another, I don't feel like I have a short attention span, but I get bored really quickly. Like, I learn things, I get it, and then I kind of want to, like, learn more things. So at my current job at Pastel, I felt like I didn't learn everything I needed to learn yet. There were still more things that I'm building within the company itself, because it's so young. It's just, there's only 5 of us right now. And I have so much autonomy and responsibility, and, like, I'm at the stage where I think there is so much value in seeing something through, in staying and seeing the growth and the iteration of a product or the company or, like, anything in life, really, right? Whereas before I would, like, jump a lot more. But I made that decision when I got that offer to stay, because I felt like there was still more growth in me. Where I am. And something that, like, I kind of think about a lot, I remember when I was, I think, 20 or 21, and I was backpacking in Spain or Italy. I was in a museum. Like, I love going to museums and galleries and stuff. It just feels like home somehow. Like, wherever in the world you are, you're going to a museum, you're going to a gallery. It's like almost like the same feeling. And like, I was just walking and looking at the art. And then suddenly I just stopped and I had this epitome moment. And I thought, okay, like, what is my greatest fear in life? And, you know, a lot of people are scared of like spiders and death and all this kind of stuff. But literally, my greatest fear in life is to be stagnant, like to not grow. And for a while, when I moved to Toronto, like the first like few years and was like super tough, like I was stagnant. And I was also stagnant in Japan after a while as well. And that was a big realization of like, hey, like I've been here, I'm comfortable with my job. Like I'm not growing. Like I can't really like grow with this job anymore. It is time to move on. And that stagnant energy was like a big reason why I moved on as well from Japan. That was a bit like convoluted and stuff, but
no, that makes complete sense. And yeah, I mean, funny enough, we're like 45 minutes in and we haven't even talked about coding. And but if anything, it really just shows whoever's listening just like your mindset and how you kind of approach general things in life, but also maybe we could kind of go back into some aspect of coding. And I don't really need to know too much about like how you got into coding, because there's plenty of that out there, plenty of it out there. But what I'm more curious about is what got you interested in coding, and was it just so challenging that this was something new? I'm kind of feeling stagnant at my current position where I'm at, and like coding is just so new that it's gonna keep me uncomfortable for a while.
Honestly, it was desperation. Like I said, the first few years being in Toronto were really, really hard. I was working like three jobs. My partner was also working three jobs, so between us we had six jobs. Like it's crazy to think back. It's just like really, really dark time. And are you familiar with Maslow's hierarchy of needs?
Heard of it. I can't like just say it off the top of my head.
Okay, so it's like this triangle that kind of represents like a model of like living, I suppose. Like at the bottom, it's like your physiological needs, like food, shelter, water, that kind of stuff. You go up, there's safety, which is, you know, like employment, money, that kind of stuff. You go up again, I think it's social, like community, love, that kind of stuff. And then you go up, it's like creativity or esteem. And then you get to the top, it's self-actualization. Yeah, like purpose and living your best life and that kind of stuff. I was living at like the bottom for a long time, getting to Toronto after, you know, like Japan and everything. And so I needed to get my basic needs met. I had my basic needs met, but I didn't have the safety. Like all the jobs I was doing were so precarious. I didn't have any money that I could really fall back on or anything. So my main motivation was literally like to have like some kind of financial stability. And stability was never really something that I was big on. I'm like really big on like freedom and exploration, and those are kind of values that me personally like I resonate with. But I wasn't able to get myself to the top at that stage where I used to be, where those needs were met. So I'm living in Toronto where it was like pretty expensive. I started looking into how can I get money. Like literally, it's like I looked into like health, I looked into like even a security guard. I was like, how crazy is that? Like, would that be a good career? And when coding came back into the picture, I wasn't sure about it at first because I had studied a little bit of coding at university and I didn't really like it. But, you know, I did like my due diligence. There was stuff like about boot camps. I like had a look and everything. And I signed up for a part-time course. And it was in that part-time course that as I started to get better at it, I felt like, okay, this might be... this might be something that I can look into a bit more. Like I'm not loving it. Like, I don't hate it. I don't like love it right now, but it's kind of interesting. I can do a lot more things than I used to be able to. So let's go with it. Let's, you know, go down this path and see where it takes me. So that was my approach.
Weird question to ask. Yeah. But if I was to say that you could only, you know, of those six jobs or three jobs that you were doing, you only had to do one of those jobs, but your life was very high on that pyramid. Do you think you would actually look into coding?
Probably, because those jobs that I was doing was like hospitality, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. It wasn't meaningful.
And okay, so
meaning
that's a
community, please. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's a great answer because I was gonna ask, like, is it, there is a sense of desperation, which I totally acknowledge, and I kind of resonate with that too, because I basically quit my job, saved just enough money to go to a coding bootcamp, and then maybe survive like 3 months later or whatever.
Yeah.
But on top of that, I think maybe it's satisfaction with what you were doing, right? And maybe that wasn't there, and something that could actually challenge you, but at the same time kind of step you on top of that pyramid ladder, or whatever you want to call it. It kind of gets you there. So I was just always curious, like, if your needs are met, then where, at what point do you feel like it's still not enough, right? And maybe coding was kind of hitting those needs. So
yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So what do you, I think coding is so interesting because to me, you're a very creative person. You love to draw. You love to kind of think about the pixel perfect design and all of those aspects of what can I create with this? Mm-hmm. Do you ever feel like coding kind of gets a little plain, or I don't really know how I want to word this, because to me, like, I don't think I'm that creative. I'm just the coder that can come up with complex ways to solve this problem and like render stuff and whatever,
but
right?
That's creativity though.
It is, but it's like a different type of creativity. Like, do you feel like you ever miss like the design creativity of your, like, of your brain? I don't know. I know we were going to talk about the left brain, right brain.
No, it's all good.
But do you ever feel that coding doesn't necessarily satisfy that aspect of creativity where you're able to be more kind of fluid with your thinking? Because sometimes coding is somewhat rigid, like you have to put those if conditionals, or you have to put the stuff into the store and then you pull the data from the store. There's like patterns versus just like, hey, why can't I just put it onto, like, I don't know, local storage just because I want to and be kind of unique with it, right? There's like pretty good standards that you have to follow. With coding, do you just, there, I think there is a bit of a good challenge to it where it's, you're always learning something new, but do you sometimes feel restricted with the way coding?
That's a great question. Yeah. When I think of creativity, where creativity flourishes is within structure and restrictions. Mm. The best kind of creativity and like ideas come from when you're like restricted and you have like certain limits, and then you're able to work within those limits. That's kind of how I think about it. Do I miss design? I still do like a little bit of design here and there. And in a company startup where there's only five of us, I do tend to like flex those skills a lot with just like the UI and all the front end things that I'm doing. So I don't actually miss it. Right now, I'm so into coding and all the possibilities of what I can do with code that I don't miss design. In some ways, I actually like it has less ambiguity than design, because design, there's a lot of like emotional, sure, there's like patterns and things that you follow and certain like stuff that comes with, you know, like whatever paradigms and whatever you gotta think about, but I don't quite miss it, because it's, design is hard, because like it's really hard to think about something like from scratch and like to build something. Like, I have like ways that I approach it, like certain like processes that I use to design something, but I don't really need those things as much when I'm coding. And in some ways that is a relief, because even though in some aspects coding is harder, I don't have to, it's less subjective, and there's a
just
bit of
tell me what to do, tell me what to make kind of thing.
Yeah. But I still feel like in many ways, like to do one thing, right, there's a variety of ways you can do it. And that still kind of like messes with me a little bit, because I'm always thinking like, am I doing it right? Like, is this the right way? And because we're such a small company, I don't know sometimes. Like, I have my CTO to look at my code. but is this the right way? Like, that's his way. Like, I want to know like all the ways and find like the most optimal or best way. But then there's like time constraints and you got a shipper and like all this other stuff, right? So right. Yeah, it's just different.
I guess the beauty of design, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that it's so subjective that there really is no real right way. Maybe it's some best practices here and there, especially with websites.
To an extent.
Everything kind of looks the same.
No, to an extent. I feel like that's more, art is more subjective, but design serves a like business, like there's a business means to an end with design. Mm. There's things that you can do with like your fonts, the fonts that you choose, the colors that you choose that communicate certain things. You get it.
Yeah. No, I mean, this is why I'm not a designer, right? I just tell me what to do. But
don't use Comic Sans.
Exactly.
I guess it has a place, time and place.
I mean, I think it's really cool to have someone on a team that could think about both in a pretty active way versus just like a passive way. It's like, oh yeah, I kind of know design, or yeah, just it is what it is. I'll just code it right away, kind of thing. But now that you're kind of, you know, you're a few years in, you're like into software development, and I think I've heard some stories that you've cried before because of JavaScript. Do you feel that you've kind of persevered through that? Are you a little bit a tougher Annie? Can you handle stress better as a developer?
I cry every day.
No, you don't. Oh, don't lie. We paired together and you weren't crying then.
Oh yeah, I cried afterwards.
I'm sorry.
No, I'm kidding. Am I a more of like a better coder?
Resilient developer, Annie? I guess.
maybe not. I'm not really sure. I know that like I know how to map through things now, whereas like before I didn't. And there's a lot more things with the code base that I can do a lot faster. And when I look at my old code, like I would just like something just like refactor it a lot faster and easily. And I'm like, why did I write that? So I know that in the last 2.5 years since I've joined, like, you know, gotten into tech, there is definitely growth. In some ways, I do feel like some of that growth has slowed down a little bit, because when I, at the beginning of the pandemic, before I got this job, I was doing a lot of like self-study and, you know, CSS art and stuff with SVGs. And when I got into my current job, there was so much learning that I was not able to do anything outside of work, because like my brain was just like the cognitive load of my job. I had nothing left at the end of the day. I couldn't, you know, do anything else. And recently I've been feeling like, hey, I'm actually in a place now where I do have a bit more energy, because like I feel like with work as well, it's a bit less time management, it's almost like more energy management. And I'm feeling like now I do have a little bit more energy for things, like I want to start up some of those stuff again. But also at the same time, because I'm involved with the community and everything, and I do a lot of things like, you know, write articles or give talks and stuff, and that recently I've realized that those were things that I've kind of fallen into, and it wasn't something that I intentionally pursued. And it's a process of like me being more intentional with my time now that is kind of where I am at this point today as I speak to you on April 26th of 2022. Yeah,
there's just so many ways to go about this tech community, and even I'm feel kind of lost at times, especially because what is my identity here? Am I a software engineer? Am I someone on Twitter that's helping people break into tech? Is that my goal? Why am I on Twitter? Why am I giving interviews? I know we talked about this before as well, but at the end of the day, if I learned anything from you and just even your past, you gotta do what makes you happy. And at the same time, do what pays the bills and makes you comfortable. So if you could find that right balance between finding what you're good at, finding what you enjoy, get paid for it, and you know, you don't have to do the extra stuff if you don't want to, right? Sometimes it stumbles upon you really quickly, and then you might think that, oh, this is my identity now, so I need to do this because everybody else is doing it and all of those things. But maybe you could also think about what has gotten you here, right? And it's mm-hmm. like in some aspects, like especially like your Twitter following, I know like you shared a lot to me with like those images and pictures and drawings, and I was like, wow, that's really cool. I haven't seen you do that in a really long time.
Yeah.
And I personally would love to see stuff like that. I think you're obviously a super great person and love hearing your interviews, but just hearing some other aspects of who Annie is through her creativity, I think would be like a really awesome way to reintroduce yourself to the community. So
yeah, let's see where that goes. I have to say though, the thing about identity is that it's so malleable, right? Like you're not under any obligation to be the same person, you know, you were yesterday. And here's a really interesting fact. Like your body, like literally, like physically, you are not the same person you were 10 years ago. Like your cells have undergone like the renewal process. Like literally every single cell in your body is different. And I feel like that's such a powerful but scary thing as well. It's powerful because you can literally like decide to be a different person, but it's also very difficult because it's hard to, you know, to change that, right? To become like a different person from who you are today. And there's like patterns and all that kind of stuff. But it's just interesting to think about. And I know like just, and I just want to talk about identity for a little bit just because you brought it up, but also because my identity from moving from a designer to developer, that was really hard for me. Like I was so attached to me as a designer and being like, hey, I go to like design things. And now I go to tech conferences. It was quite a shift for me to like to jump from that. And personally for me, that was like one of the hurdles that I had to personally get over. So yeah.
Not to rag on English teachers, but did you ever feel that similar
no.
mindset?
No, I was just doing like English teaching as like I was
this
still
is just, this is just paying the bills. Well, what do you think your identity was then? Just an explorer?
Expat designer who hasn't designed for a while and just like random person, just
cartwheel, acrobatic,
yeah,
individual.
Traveling, snowboarding, scuba diving, whatever, hiking.
I love it. But speaking of community, what do you think about just being able to have a tech community? Because I think one thing that is really different from maybe what you had before was this temporary just like relationships, right? Because right now, at least with the tech community, assuming that, you know, like talks will You're come right. Or conferences will come up, you still meet them physically. But right now it's pretty remote heavy. Most people interact remotely. How has that been for you? Has that been giving you the energy to like really build community within the tech?
One of the things that energizes me is like people and community. When I'm a developer, I don't just work, you know, in a silo by myself. And I discovered very, very early on with becoming a developer that one of the things that is like amazing about the developer community or tech community in general are the conferences. Like I love going to conferences because, okay, I haven't gone to like that many because 6 months after I started, the pandemic happened. But, yeah, I know. But like being in a, it was like one of the things that I remember very clearly, like being in a big like room where everyone was there to learn, and the feeling of being inspired by someone and that we're all moving together towards this kind of almost like a common goal of like making the web a better place, making it a more accessible place, making it like more open to other people and those kind of things. Like we're building something together. And when I think about that, like my work is not just me at Pastel, like, you know, like mapping through like some canvases and whatever. It's more than that. It's like I'm contributing to something like beyond my work at Pastel. And I think that's why community is so important to me. And also something that I forgot what I was gonna say. Oh, it's on the tip of, okay. When I first started on Twitter, after starting to get to know people, this was a really strange feeling for me. I don't know if you like had this feeling too, but as your friends on Twitter started to spread into other parts of your life, into like LinkedIn and Instagram and everything, and like it just it changed. Like Twitter was this bubble and it was just like those people. But then as it spread, it became more, I don't know how to explain it, but I do remember thinking that, oh, this is different. It's like the real world. Like I'm not in the tech Twitter bubble anymore. Like suddenly everything is like more expansive. Did you experience that? Like,
I definitely did that, where they weren't just avatars and usernames. These were real people. And especially during the whole pandemic, I never expected some of these people to be people I talk to on a frequent basis. And in some ways, it makes me feel a lot more comfortable about the longevity of it, in a sense that maybe, you know, like before in Japan, what kept you together within this community was the location and was the fact that you were so used to seeing each other every day or so frequently. But at least with the tech community, there are going to be moments where you do see each other physically, but more often than not, it's going to be remote. And that way you could have these, you could build more consistent relationships because it's mostly internet based, right? So it still feels like you're part of a really like large community, and like, the collaborations are still there. It's funny because sometimes like your best friends are people you don't even talk to on a
frequent basis
because you're not messaging them every day. But at least in tech, or the people I meet in tech, I'm talking to them more than my real friends that I actually meet in person. Not saying the tech people I meet aren't real friends, but you know what I mean. It's like people I've actually physically talked to for many years, essentially. So it's just funny how like it's just kind of flipped in that way. So that's a great point. And I think that's what ultimately, you know, even led to me meeting you, in a sense. Like I was kind of, it was just kind of crazy how I don't even know actually how I ended up following you, because I remember you asked me, why did you follow me then? I was like, I don't remember. I'm pretty sure it was Face or something. And that kind of led to that. But yeah, I mean, overall, what a great story, Annie. And hopefully you were able to share a little bit of these insider Aussie information that people might not have known. And at the same time, people can know that you have a video up of you doing some acrobats if they really try hard enough.
That is so funny.
But overall, like, how do you... I'm still thinking about that pyramid that you were saying. Where do you feel like you're at right now?
I'm definitely above safety. Probably above the kind of social aspect, like belonging, and I feel like my psychological needs are met. Maybe I'm working on like esteem, maybe like confidence, in having more confidence in my abilities, as you know, someone who works in engineering. Like the whole imposter syndrome is still a little bit real for me a bit, and like being able to say no to things is like maybe working towards just try and get some of that creativity back, I guess.
Yeah.
So I'm getting up there. That's good.
Yeah, I feel like I'm pretty up there too. And in some way, shape, or form, I'm trying to figure out meaning and purpose a little bit more.
Yeah.
And I mean, obviously, it's a very privileged position to be in, but I definitely worked my butt off to get break out of those levels. And you start really wondering, why do you do what you do, right? Like, I don't, you know, sometimes being a coder or developer, it feels like a mercenary. Like, hey, code this for me, or hey, code this feature for me. Brain off, just code kind of thing. And these days, that's kind of what I've been trying to figure out. And, you know, that's why I made a podcast as well, where I could just talk to really awesome people. And it's funny, even though I have these questions lined up, I don't know what answers to expect. So it evolves throughout the conversations. And now it's less more about an interview and me just trying to figure out, hey, what else can I learn from you while I'm talking to you? So this has been super fun for me. But before I close out, is there anything you want to share? The floor is yours. Open mic. Go at it.
Well, I just want to say that, first of all, this interview was really fun for me as well. I've done like a number of interviews and it's usually very like technically focused or about like my story. And I just felt like in this interview specifically, we were able to get into more like deeper things and like meta things. And it was just a very fun conversation to have. So like, yeah, like thank you so much for, you know, like all your research and stuff. And like, you're such a good host as well. And I'm glad that, so right now I'm just like expecting the mic to cut off or something, because that time on the Twitter spaces, so I was like, Alex is great. And then boom, like my phone died. No, it didn't die. I was on Android. That's right. Android kicked me off. Yeah, but it's been a really, like, the time has just gone by really fast. And yeah, just, I really appreciate it. And I do want to say, like, just for anyone listening and stuff, like, if, like, the path that you take as you go into tech is always going to be your own. And there's going to be all sorts of advice, like, given to you and thrown at you. And at the end of the day, like, it's, you, like, you have to do your due diligence in taking that advice and then kind of like integrating it and thinking about it and coming out the other side going like, okay, what works for me and what might not? Because you're not the same person as the person who gave the advice. You're not in the same place, the same time. Like, there's all these different things and factors that play in. So it's something that I thought about. It's like, sometimes you feel like in tech, there's like a roadmap to get from like A to B, but that roadmap looks so different from like person to person. And it's, I think it's important to just kind of like recognize that. So yeah, I don't know where I was really going for. I kind of want to encourage people, and I was just like, hey, like, do your work, do your due diligence. But you know,
I agree with that completely. And maybe if I could just share a little bit about even just the purpose of this podcast. I think number one, it's also just kind of talking about something else with the people in tech kind of thing outside of like how they got into tech. But weirdly enough, the more we dig into it, it kind of does do that actually with how they got into tech. It's just, we dive in a little bit deeper, and if anything, it really just shows, to your point, everybody does have a different journey. Like when I talked to Ale, like, she traveled to China and like learned computer science there. Like Joel, he didn't know a lick of English when he came to New York, and you know, was a dishwasher and did those things. I mean, it's just so easy to just go from like point A to point B, or what seems like point A to point B, but there's actually like point A1, point A2, point A99. Like, everybody has their journey. And I think what I really want to get out of this podcast is dig a little bit deeper, going from point A to point B, but, you know, do it in a way where it does take time to get there, right? It's not just like, hey, I went from a designer to a developer.
Yeah.
Ask me anything. like it's, it doesn't work that way. Yeah. So I really, really had a great time, Annie. And just, if anyone wants to go to Japan and need some recommendations, I'll be sure to let them know.
If you like mushrooms, I know a great mushroom restaurant in Osaka. So good.
You gotta... Yeah, of all things, you know, mushrooms, like, definitely check out the mushrooms. Well, appreciate your time, Annie, and thank you again. And for those of you that are listening, I'll see you in the next episode. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a comment to show support. This episode will be available on YouTube and various other podcast platforms. Tech Rally out.